I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we will hear from the Democratic candidate who will face off against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker in June's closely watched recall election. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett joins us in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to the always emotional, often explosive issue of same-sex marriage. In a move that came as a shock to many people, President Obama announced yesterday that he supports, that he personally supports gay marriage in an interview with ABC's Robin Roberts. Here's a clip from the full interview that aired this morning on Good Morning America.
At a certain point, I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
Although many people have long suspected that the president has been sympathetic to same-sex marriage, he has said in the past that he supports civil rights for same-gender-loving couples, but he said that his views on marriage are evolving. But that unequivocal declaration puts President Obama at odds with the presumptive GOP nominee, Mitt Romney. This is a clip from Romney's Wednesday afternoon interview on KDVR-TV in Denver. Let's listen.
I do not favor marriage between people of the same gender, and I don't favor civil unions if they're identical to marriage other than by name.
That discussion, along with North Carolina's vote on Tuesday to ban same-sex unions in the state constitution, has put the issue back on the top of the political agenda. And it also turns a spotlight on the role faith might be playing in the presidential race. So we wanted to talk about this with two journalists who cover the intersection of faith and politics. Sarah Posner is the senior editor of Religion Dispatches. That is an online publication that covers religion, politics, and culture from a progressive perspective. She's also the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Also with us once again, David Brody. He is the chief political correspondent for the Christian Broadcasting Network that was founded, of course, by the conservative evangelical leader, the Reverend Pat Robertson. He is the author of the forthcoming book, The T-Evangelicals, the inside story of how evangelicals, the Tea Party, and presidential contenders are trying to take back America. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks
once again.
Thanks for having us,
Thanks,
Michelle.
Sarah, I'm going to start with you. Why now? Why do you think the president made this announcement now?
Well, I think that it was becoming evident that he needed to do something. He was being boxed in by his own position of saying that he was evolving. Yet all around him, other Democrats, including his own vice president, were saying that they were for same-sex marriage. And to continue to say that he was opposed to it in the face of public opinion and even in the face of elite opinion was making him look behind the curve.
David, I want to ask you about why as well. And also want to mention in your column about this, you said, this comes as no surprise, quoting here, you say that the fact that the president's views were evolving, and you had that in quotes, on this for a couple of years simply was code for, let me figure out when best to drop the bombshell. When Vice President Biden seemed to take care of the timing on all that with his appearance on Meet the Press this past Sunday, watching Jay Carney, that's his press secretary, duck incoming fire didn't help.
Right.
That's your usual stuff. But you know what about Sarah's point is that Pew Research polls, for example, from this year, say that even a majority of independents are in favor of same-sex marriage. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to wait to see how this plays out. I mean, 57%, I think, of independents favor same-sex marriage. If you go deep inside those polls, though, a lot of those rural counties, as it relates to independents, don't agree with same-sex marriage whatsoever. I mean, so I think we wait and see how this plays out. As for the timing of it, all of this, I totally agree with Sarah. And just to say that, look, did the president want to announce this on a Wednesday by calling Robin Roberts over to the White House to make this announcement? No, of course not. You know, this was relatively bungled, but done as best possible under the circumstances.
Why was it bungled? Bungled how? You think he was boxed in? He was, in fact, boxed in by Vice President Biden? Because some are saying that, in fact, that he was, in fact, testing the waters. It's kind of like sending up the trial balloon.
Yeah, it was becoming a negative media story for the president. Jay Carney really looking like he was dodging bullets there in the White House briefing room. The vice president, as I like to say, stepped in it, as we shall say, on Sunday. Not the first time, I might say that he did that. So, I mean, it just was not there to tee up properly, and it seemed a little like a rush job.
What is changed by this, David?
Well, I think we're going to find out. But I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a looser electoral map now. In other words, how to get to 270 electoral votes in 2012. All of a sudden, a lot of red states, typical red states that Obama won in 2008, North Carolina, Indiana, Virginia, Iowa, I can go on.
But tell me why you think that.
But those states, because they are typically, they will typically lean a little bit more red. They're purple states, but they are kind of red leaning, at least in the past. All of a sudden, that opens it up for Mitt Romney to do much better in those states than previously, potentially. So we'll see.
But why do you think that, given that everybody says that people are saying that the economy is number one? I mean, that clearly socially conservative voters preferred other Republican nominees like Rick Santorum. But in the end of the day, it went to Mitt Romney because I think the consensus was that people figured the economy was the issue and he was the best candidate on that issue.
Well, I think the demographics, it depends on each state. But I mean, for example, there's going to be problems, and we'll maybe talk about it within the black community, obviously. That's going to be an issue, not to mention some of the rural counties. And quite frankly, if you look within the independent polling, you will not just see it just be 57% of independents approve of same-sex marriage. Actually, if you look at that socially conservative independent vote, which is what President Obama needs in places like Pennsylvania and others, that has been a problem for him in the past, and it could be even more of a problem in the future.
We're talking about President Obama's announcement that he personally supports same-sex marriage. We're talking with people who spend a lot of time thinking about and writing about the intersection of faith and politics. David Brody is with the Christian Broadcasting Network. That's who is speaking just now. Sarah Posner is also with us of Religion Dispatches. So, Sarah, what about David's point? Two key portions of the president's constituency, the progressive coalition, if you want to call it that, African-Americans and Latinos, otherwise strong supporters of the president.
Right.
But on this issue, there tends to be at variance with the perspective of other people within the progressive coalition. They tend to be much more skeptical of same-sex marriage than white liberals are.
Right. Well, a couple of things on that. One is the demographics on that are changing. When you look at the viewpoint of millennial African-Americans and millennial Latinos on same-sex marriage, they're much more in favor of it than their elders are. The second is how much this statement that Obama made yesterday will actually impact their vote when they're looking at Obama versus Romney and issues of the economy or foreign policy or the other unemployment, other things that might be mattering to them right now. Are they really going to change their vote based exclusively on Obama's stated position on same-sex marriage? And I think there's not a lot of evidence that that's the case. And I also think that once people start to realize what the strategy has been of the conservative Christian organizations who are opposed to same-sex marriage. The recent revelation that the National Organization for Marriage had a strategy of trying to drive a wedge between Democrats and Latino and African-American supporters over this issue, that might give them pause about the motivation of the anti-same-sex marriage movement if they think that they're being used to drive a wedge between their community and the Democratic Party.
David? Well, let me just make a couple points. First of all, I think this actually could really very much not just energize the president's base, but he really needs those younger, under 30, those millennials to turn out. And so clearly this has political benefit. Obviously, has a lot of political risk as well. But the truth of the matter is that the problem here, and this is why I think Obama, the advantage is with Obama on this, is because candidate Romney isn't the type of candidate that's going to really make this an issue. I mean, he wants to run away from this issue. I mean, look what happened today. Their press people put out this, what's going on in the world today in Romney land, and not same-sex marriage, and the president's announcement wasn't mentioned at all. President Romney, not exactly.
Presumptive Republican nominee.
I've been reading too many Republican talking points, I think. But candidate Romney does not want to touch this issue. And because he doesn't want to touch this issue, I think it makes much harder to basically get some political hay out of this in many of these swing states.
Well, what about the fact that you've also written about the fact that presumptive GOP nominee is speaking at Liberty University this Saturday. He's offering an address there. You felt that this was an important sign. Tell us why.
Sure.
Will he talk about it there?
Well, talk about what? It depends.
It's gay marriage.
No, I don't anticipate that to be at all brought up. And once again, why won't it be brought up? Because Romney is a Mr. Fix-It, the economy, the economy, the economy. It's all he wants to talk about. And so he doesn't want to get down into the social issues. And so that's the reason he won't do that there. But at Liberty University, real quick, no. I mean, he's going to talk about the budget and immorality, and he's going to appeal to evangelicals from an economic standpoint.
So our final thought I wanted to ask you about, the president in his Good Morning America interview, the president said that his faith brought him to this decision. But he also previously cited his faith when he talked about his support for traditional marriage and why he wasn't really ready to go all the way there.
Right.
I just wanted to ask, what do you think it means for the president to invoke his faith when expressing support for same-sex marriage?
I think it's a very important moment for the president politically in terms of how he relates his faith to his policies, and also in terms of how politically, how he has tried to reach religious voters. During the 08 campaign and throughout most of his first term, he has employed this conservative religious rhetoric about traditional marriage and marriage being between one man and one woman, and resorting to that sort of talking point instead of the sort of talking point that he used yesterday, which was about the golden rule and everybody being treated equally. And so I think that that's a very important message, considering that he has in the past not really reached out to religious leaders who are pro-gay marriage and has tended to try to make public appearances with people like Rick Warren or Jill Hunter who are opposed to same-sex marriage. So I think it's an important – politically – an important message that he's trying to send with regard to his faith outreach and his faith alliances.
Sarah Posner is the senior editor of Religion Dispatches. That's an online publication that covers religion, politics, and culture from a progressive perspective. Also with us, David Brody. He is the chief political correspondent for the Christian Broadcasting Network that was founded by the evangelical leader, the Reverend Pat Robertson, and author of a forthcoming book called The T-Evangelicals. Thank you both so much for joining us here
Thanks,
in our
Michelle.
Studios in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Michelle.
And we're going to continue this conversation tomorrow by taking a closer look at how President Obama's announcement will affect the Black community. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Mother's Day is just around the corner, and in Mexico, in fact, it is today. So if you are still searching for a way to pay tribute to mom, why not do it up big the way they do in Mexico and hire a mariachi band? Mother's Day is actually one of the biggest days of the year for mariachi musicians. We will hear more about that in just a few minutes. But first, we have a newsmaker interview with one of the men who will be at the center of one of the most closely watched races this election year. Tom Barrett is the mayor of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But 2 years ago, he made a bid for the governor's office in Wisconsin and lost to the current governor, Scott Walker. But this week, Wisconsin Democrats chose him from a field of Democratic candidates to stand against Walker in a recall vote in June. And Tom Barrett joins us now by phone. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
And I should mention that we did speak to Governor Walker on this program a few months ago. We've been reaching out, asking him to join us once again. You know, having said that, Mr. Mayor, what do you think you've learned in the 2 years since your last race that makes you better equipped to beat Mr. Walker this time?
Well, actually, I don't know that it's so much what I've learned. I think it's what the people of Wisconsin have learned, because in 2010, Scott Walker ran on a platform of creating 250,000 jobs. But soon after taking office, he completely reversed course. And rather than focusing on creating jobs, he launched an ideological civil war here in the state by going after workers' rights. And unfortunately, Wisconsin, under Scott Walker, lost more jobs in 2011 than any other state in the entire country. So there's really several reasons why this has happened. And I think the people of the state of Wisconsin are now saying, wait a minute, you said you were going to come in and focus on jobs. And instead of doing that, you've become the darling of the far right and are traveling around the country giving fundraising speeches about how successful you've been in going after workers' rights.
You think that the voters of Wisconsin will have buyer's remorse?
Well, that'll be the question, and I think they will. And I can tell you I've run for office many, many times, and this is the first time I've ever had anybody, and this has happened many, many times, come up to me and apologize, say, I'm sorry I didn't vote for you. And my response is always, go and sin no more.
Well, as you mentioned, the major factor driving the recall effort was Governor Walker's efforts to limit collective bargaining rights for some public workers. I'm saying some because most public safety workers are exempt. But it's been widely reported, Mr. Mayor, that this law actually saved your city millions of dollars in labor costs. First of all, do you think that that is in fact true? Do you credit that reporting? And secondly, does that complicate your ability to make this an issue?
If you think a little bit more about what their criticism is of me, their criticism of me is that I was fiscally responsible. And if they want to debate whether I was fiscally responsible and they're on the side that I'm fiscally responsible, I'm happy to agree with them on that. But what I had to do facing the largest cut that the city of Milwaukee ever faced from state government was make a decision whether I was going to lay people off or not. And I chose not to lay people off. And as a result, they're saying, well, you used the tools that we gave you. But my view is, look, I wasn't going to lay people off during a time when your leadership was resulting in the state of Wisconsin losing more jobs than any other state.
Isn't that the core of the governor's argument, though, that the state needed this flexibility in order to close a yawning statewide budget gap?
There are two separate issues. The one issue is whether employees should pay more towards their health care and pensions, and even the leaders of the unions agreed with that. But no one saw coming this attack on collective bargaining and workers' rights. That really was the spark that started the entire unrest here in the state of Wisconsin.
Most of the big public sector unions in Wisconsin backed your primary opponent, the former Dane County executive Kathleen Falk. They are endorsing you now, as I understand it.
That's correct, yes.
But do you feel you need more work to do to convince rank-and-file members that you are the best choice? And what's your best argument to them?
Well, actually, I don't think I ever had a problem with the rank-and-file. So that was probably one of the reasons that I won the primary by such a convincing amount, was the rank-and-file understood where I was coming from, because a lot of them would have been affected, and they were the ones whose jobs I was trying to save and make sure they weren't being laid off.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with the mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barrett. He won Tuesday's Democratic primary election, and he won the right to face Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker next month in a recall election. You know, there's been a lot of national interest in this race on both sides, and people have criticized Governor Walker, as you just did, I think, for kind of barnstorming around the country. He's accepted a lot of money. There's been a lot of money from outside the state brought into this race. And I'm wondering if the national interest in this race, does it help or does it hurt from your perspective?
Well, here in Wisconsin, we've never seen anything like we've seen Governor Walker do in the last 3 months, where he raised 60% to 70% of his money, which was $13 million, from out of state. And a lot of these were contributions that were huge contributions. He's gotten a $500,000 contribution. He's got numerous $250,000 contributions, $100,000 contributions. And whether you're liberal or conservative, I think a lot of eyebrows in the state of Wisconsin are rising when people say, wait, there's a problem if your sitting governor is raising 60 to 70% of his money from out of state. What does this have to do with Wisconsin values? Or is this just part of the ideological civil war? And I think that's what people are beginning to recognize, that the reason he's so popular in these far-right circles is he's doing exactly what they want to do. And ultimately, if you look at Indiana, for example, the goal is to make these states right-to-work states and take away workers' rights, not just for public employees, but for private employees. And this move against public employees was the first step. But I don't want you to think that this is a one-trick pony, that that's the only issue. Again, unemployment in terms of the loss of jobs in Wisconsin is a huge issue. We are the only state between March of 2011 and March of 2012 to lose jobs. The fact that this governor has a criminal defense fund, and he's had numerous aides of his and associates charged with crimes while he was county executive, and there's a John Doe proceeding right now. There are lots and lots of issues, the war against women, the huge cut in education. So it's true that it was the workers' rights that started this prairie fire, if you want to call it that, but it has spread dramatically because of what's happened here in the last 16 months and how, from my standpoint, it's very much a divide-and-conquer strategy.
But the reports indicate that Governor Walker is well ahead of you in the fundraising at this point, I mean, in part because you had a more vigorous challenge to face him. What are you going to do? Are you saying you're not going to accept outside funding?
Again, I don't have people from around the country giving me checks of $500,000, $250,000, $100,000. Again, he's part of a national movement. Now, don't make any mistake about that. But what was most interesting was a week before the primary, there was a poll out and showed even though he had outraised me approximately 25 to 1, I was 1 point ahead in that poll. So what I've said to my followers is buckle up. We're in for a wild ride.
Given that there is, and, you know, we are outside of the state, although we, you know, we do appreciate your giving us the opportunity to speak with you. And there is national interest in this race. Many people are calling the elections this fall, a number of them, as kind of a referendum on where we are as a country on some of these big questions. And there are differences in philosophy at work here, differences in ideology at work here. Do you see this race as a referendum in general, kind of as kind of a national kind of bellwether of what's going on here? And what do you think national voters should read into what's going on in Wisconsin?
Well, again, Scott Walker has said that if he's successful here, that what he's tried to do here, again, going after workers' rights, beginning with going after the public workers, but again, looking at Indiana, you can see that it ultimately reaches the private workers as well, that his actions here will spread throughout the country. So he wants, again, the right-wing ideologues who are believe in right to work to support him, and they are supporting him in huge numbers. We have a much different scenario on our side. I think that the people of this state want to have this election decided according to Wisconsin values, not according to ideological values that are not within this state.
Tom Barrett is the mayor of Milwaukee. He is the Democratic nominee who will face Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, a Republican, in next month's recall election. And he was kind enough to join us by phone from Milwaukee. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And once again, we have reached out to Governor Walker to join us once again, and we'll keep you posted. Now we have a little reminder for those of you who may be a little forgetful when it comes to holidays. If you have been procrastinating or just not sure what to get mom for Mother's Day, we have a suggestion. This year, you might skip the flowers and that overbooked brunch. Have a little music to say, thanks, Mom. That was Mariachi Los Amigos playing Tequila con Limón. And this might surprise you, Mother's Day is one of the busiest holidays for mariachi bands. They can be booked months in advance. And so with that in mind, and also on the fact that this is the day that mothers are celebrated in Mexico, we thought we'd take a look at the art of mariachi music. Joining us is Dan Sheehy. He is the director for the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian Institution. He's also a member of Mariachi Los Amigos. That is Washington, D.C.'s oldest mariachi band. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Why did mariachi bands get booked up for Mother's Day? So actually, with as far as you're concerned, it's actually too late for Mother's Day.
Well, no, there are a few little spaces here and there.
Okay. But well, why is that?
Well, it goes back before there was an official Mother's Day, actually. You know, mariachi music, gee, and ever since we know that there was mariachi music back in the 1850s, at least, they played serenades. They played for parties. They played for special things called mañanitas, which means literally early in the morning, and it had to do with a serenade. So they go serenade people's loved ones and mothers in particular.
So what you'll do is you'll go from house to house on Mother's Day, really for the whole weekend, playing for mom.
Yeah, it depends. Yeah. In the United States, since we live in a little more controlled environment, let's say, than Mexico, there are lots of stories about mariachis playing outside at 5 o'clock in the morning and suddenly the trumpet player disappears because somebody arrested him and took him off or something like that. But yeah, it's very popular. And in the United States, people generally charge by the hour. So they're mariachis. You hire for an hour. They show up at mom's house and play the songs that they want to hear.
Well, it is Mother's Day in Mexico, so why don't we hear a little bit of Amor de Madre, and this is the version played by Mariachi Lobo.
Dame por Dios tu bendición,
oh madre mía dorada,
que yo a tus pies pido perdón.
Por lo que tanto he sufrido,
ahora que estás.
Is this a popular one for Mother's Day?
That's totally popular for Mother's Day. Madrecita querida, or beloved mom, is another one of those popular ones. That actually, Amor de Madre came out of the Norteño tradition in the northern part of Mexico, but since it just hits the target straight on, love for mother, you know, all the mariachis play it, and any kind of serenading type group, you know, trios or mariachis or whatever.
Do you open with this one, or do you kind of work your way up?
Sometimes, you know, I'll tell you, the relationship between mariachis and clients, so to speak, in people's houses or whatever, is a very close one. So you generally don't go and do a set of music. You go and you play what people want to hear.
Dan, would it be rude of me to point out that you're not Mexican?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. I've only heard that for 44 years.
Yes. So how did you get involved in playing mariachi music? And how did you get involved with Mariachi Los Amigos? I mean, the group's been together since, what, 1978?
That's right. Well, the short version of the story is just good luck. I just fell in with mariachis, and it's been great ever since. I was playing rhythm and blues, actually, in Los Angeles, in Compton. And our guitar player was recruited by War, and that was pretty much the end of the Thunder Brothers at that point. And I was also playing at UCLA as a graduate student, or an undergraduate at that point, playing Ashanti drumming music. And one of the musicians in that group with me said, "Hey, we have this mariachi. I hear you're out of work with the R&B group. Why don't you come and play with us?" And I said, "Great, let's do it." And there was a man named Jesus Sanchez from Zacualco, Jalisco, a state in West Mexico. He was pure mariachi through and through. He'd played music since the 20s, and a man of great dignity and great inspiration. And that was 68, and been playing mariachi music ever since.
How do your audiences respond to you?
Well, actually,
do they even notice that you're not Mexican?
They say pretty much what you said there. They say, "Excuse me, but you don't look Mexican." And I say, if I had a quarter for every time somebody said that to me, I could.
But you speak Spanish at this point, right?
Sí,
or did
claro,
you always?
Sí, después de tantos años, sí, hablo español, sí. And I even, I don't call myself a singer, but, if you're really going to do your thing playing mariachi music, you need to play your instrument and sing as well, so everybody needs to sing.
So you do both?
That was me on the Traigo Música en el Alma, on that little recording there you had.
How big do you think your repertoire is at this point?
Well, there's things that are rehearsed and sound solid and all that. That's well over 100 tunes. But in order just to, if somebody asks for a song, you know, you can kind of improvise an arrangement out of, your back pocket or something. Several hundred in our case. I'll tell you, if you get into the heavy-duty mariachi territory there, you're talking probably a couple thousand songs easy.
How has your life changed, though, since the Latino diaspora has expanded far beyond the south, southwest of the United States and the west coast of the United States? It used to be that the Latino population was pretty much, the southwest and the west coast. And now it's national. And I wonder, has the band become more popular over time, less of a novelty, or there more competition now?
Being
in Washington, D.C.,
I have various lives. One is in folk life and also director of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. And in that role, I kind of have this national view, and I can tell you that more than one half of the United States have active mariachi groups in them these days. That didn't used to be the case. In terms of this area, it's interesting to see who's playing mariachi music here, and that's a reflection of where mariachi music is in Latin America and in the world today, because here, musicians from Bolivia, from Guatemala, from El Salvador, from Mexico, from other countries, Colombia, that's where people come from who play mariachi music here in the D.C. area.
Well, so what are you going to be doing for Mother's Day? Are you playing for, is your mom still with us or no? She's
no.
So you won't be playing for her.
The mother of my children are still with us.
Will you be playing for her?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And
we're
going to play for her.
She likes Linda Ronstadt songs, I have to tell you. So, of course, Linda Ronstadt did her great Canciones de mi Padre album and then Más Canciones album. And the mother of my children likes to sing.
You got her covered. Okay, I'm just making sure.
Totally.
Dan Sheehy is the director for the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian Institution. He is also a member of Mariachi Los Amigos. That is the Washington, D.C. area's longest continuously existing mariachi ensemble. And he was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much, and happy Mother's Day to the mothers.
Muchas gracias. Felicidades a todas las madres.
Well, for all the mothers who aren't Linda Ronstadt fans, here's Amor de Madre one more time.
Madre querida, ruega por mí al Creador. Tú que estás en la mansión de ese trono celestial, mándale a mi corazón un suspiro maternal, un suspiro maternal. Mándale a mi corazón que me llegue y que me hiere el corazón. Mira, madre.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. By now, you surely know actress and singer Vanessa Williams. She's been nominated for several Grammys for her best-selling albums. She currently stars as Renee Perry on ABC's Desperate Housewives, and you cannot have missed her iconic role as the cutthroat fashion magazine editor Wilhelmina Slater on ABC's Ugly Betty. Here's a clip.
I'm trying to figure out who my real father is.
Even if I wanted to express sympathy, I physically can't.
But what you might not know is that the inspiration for Willie's no-nonsense attitude came from Vanessa's mother, Helen, and that iron will and attitude is what helped Vanessa recover from the scandal that ironically launched her career when she was forced to give up her crown as the first African-American to hold the title of Miss America. And now the two of them have teamed up to tell it all in their new book, You Have No Idea, and Vanessa Williams is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot. I had no idea what clip that I was like, what am I about to say?
I think we should start with the most embarrassing thing in the book, which is the French horn. Really? Your mom made you play the French horn?
No, she didn't make me. I chose that.
You chose the French horn?
Yeah, I love the French horn. Hey, all French horn players unite. It's a cool instrument. Brass players are the coolest people out of the whole orchestra. So
I do love the chapters in the book, the alternating chapters with your mom, and you do reveal that that Wilhelmina's stare, the stare you got
yes.
from her. Unfortunately, we are in different cities, so I can't see the stare.
Yeah, well, my mom taught public school music for almost 40 years, and she's about 5 feet and very mighty. And she would control her kids a lot by giving them the eye or the stare, and that was one of the nuances I added to Wilhelmina very shortly after I started playing her. And a lot of my mom's friends said, "Oh boy, Helen, Vanessa's got you down."
Well, the reason I bring that up is that one of the things that you recount is that you and your brother had a very strict kind of regimen, and that you had intended to be kind of a singer, an actress, go to Broadway. And this whole Miss America thing was really not part of your game plan at all. And in fact, it was your first pageant.
I was scouted up on campus after I was performing time and time again to be in the local Miss Greater Syracuse pageant. And I'd gotten scholarships every year. My mother said, "Well, how much money are you going to make?" I said, "Well, I don't know." She said, "Well, go for it." And won the pageant.
I think it was $500. In the book, it was $500.
Yeah. won the pageant, Greater Syracuse in April, in July, won state, and won Miss America in September. So no intention at all. Major, major detour in my life, for sure.
One of the funny things about the book, though, and again, going back to the title, is that apparently this was kind of an inside joke within your circle of friends when you won. You started on the pageant road and won the first title because your friends and family were saying, "You have no idea who you just picked," because you have clearly have tremendous discipline, a tremendous work ethic, but you're also kind of a little bit of a hellraiser.
Well, I try to describe in the book the spirited nature that I had and I have. And I wanted to illustrate that when I did become Miss America, I was not the conventional Miss America that most people assumed. Again, you have no idea. When I was at Syracuse and won the Miss Syracuse pageant, one of my friends played piano. I sang a song that I had done in performance class because I didn't want to dance because that would have been too much effort. And when I won, we were back at my apartment, drinking Rolling Rock beers. I'm holding my silver platter with Miss Greater Syracuse 1983 on it. And my friends are saying they have no idea who they just chose. And it was because I was a normal kid who, you know, had a boyfriend. You know, I had premarital sex. You know, these are things that were not symbolic to what a Miss America's symbol was about.
But talk a little bit, if you would, about what that was like serving as Miss America, but also the first African-American to serve in that role. I mean, tell me when it dawned on you that, hey, this was a big deal.
Well, it was one of those unusual years where there were more minority contestants than ever. There were five of us, including one Hispanic. And so there were, you know, four black girls, Deneen Graham, who I talk about in the book, who was Miss North Carolina, who was a beautiful ballet dancer who was studying at North Carolina School of the Arts, had already had a cross burned on her front yard because she was the first black Miss North Carolina. So we knew the odds were in our favor. But the fact that, you know, I won and Suzette Charles was the first runner-up and she was biracial. But when the press started, when I would go out on the tour and do my appearances and people would come up and say they never thought they'd see it the day that it would happen, when people would want to shake my hand and you'd see tears in their eyes and they'd say, I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. That's when, you know, it was definitely a very special honor. But also, as I mentioned before, when you've got sharpshooters on buildings because they don't want to tell you, but there's been some credible threats on your life, when they say, okay, don't answer the door for anybody, even if they knock and tell you they're from room service, you check with me first. Mm. You know that, you know, there is some serious danger there. You know, when people tell you that they're going to throw acid on your face and kill you because of who you are and because that's what their intention is, it's terrifying as a 20-year-old.
I'm speaking with the award-winning singer, actress Vanessa Williams. She, along with her mother Helen, have written a memoir called You Have No Idea. You know, the interesting thing about this is that even though you're recounting events that happened a long time ago, relatively speaking, a lot of them still resonate today. Like the whole business with the, well, a couple, some really painful things you talk about in the book, but I did want to just briefly talk about the nude pictures. You know, we're living in a time when parents are trying to warn their kids about camera phone pictures and what they put on Facebook and YouTube. I'm thinking that this episode with the nude picture surfacing during, really toward the close of your reign, was kind of like the first time the idea of something, you know, pictures like that, that you don't really think about very much as a teen, kind of coming back to haunt you, might have kind of come into the consciousness. I don't know. That's just my take on it. I just wanted to ask.
Well, I mean, I think what happened to me and the betrayal and the humiliation that happened to me on a grand scale can happen so much quicker to kids that are young now, unfortunately. I mean, we got a chance to fail, and we would fail or make a mistake within our family or the community might know, but very rarely would it be worldwide. And now a kid messes up, and immediately it hits the internet, and there's a camera crew already with a story, and all of a sudden you're worldwide, you know, have worldwide attention.
But one of the things I wanted to talk about is how you talk about in the book is how somebody as strong-willed as you, as bright as you, somebody with family support, you know what I mean? You weren't out there on your own, could get kind of caught up in something like that, could get talked into something like that, even though, as you talk about in the book, you knew right away it was a mistake, but somehow you couldn't get out of it. And I just wondered if you could just briefly just talk about that, because I think that's something that will resonate with others.
Well, you know? I show I try to illustrate in the book, my mother kept saying, you're just like your father, you're too trusting. And there's a part of me that I do give people the benefit of the doubt. I do value friendships. And when people give me their word, I listen to them. And it's also being free. I try to illustrate, you know, we start the first chapter, it's called Thrill Rides, and it's about me. I like being free. When you say no, I say, well, you know what, I'm going to do it anyway. And that was the mode I was in at that particular time when I took those racy pictures, because I was already in college, so you can't tell me what to do. So I wasn't actually in high school. So my mentality was, what, I'm living my own life. I'm a spirited young woman. I can handle this. I can handle anything. And at 19, you think you rule the world and you can control things. And a lot of times you don't. And again, when, you know, everything happened with this scandal, you know, I had not signed a release. So I had trusted the person that I was had taken the photos that I'd worked for, that there was nothing legally that he could actually do.
Did you ever sue him?
Yeah, we had a lawsuit against Pentas that my parents were paying for, and mm-hmm. both of them were music teachers, so they weren't making a tremendous amount of money. And one of the stories I tell was that when, after going through a few rounds of deposition and them just being as brutal as possible to me, my lawyer said, listen, was there any time were you ever with another woman? sexually, because you know, these pictures have you with another woman, and they're going to ask you. And I said, well, the only time I was ever with another woman was when I was 10 and I was molested by an 18-year-old. And he said, well, you know, they're going to bring it up on the stand, so when we get to trial, just want you to be aware of that. And I hadn't told my parents, and I hadn't revealed this to anyone. And I said, you know what? I'm done. I don't want to go through this anymore. Sure. I want to start and move on with my life. So I tell that story just to tell people that that's why I dropped the lawsuit. Sure. My parents never really found out until my mom just recently after we finished writing the book. My little one is 11 years old now, and I could not imagine what I would have done had I known that somebody had tried to do the same thing to her at age 10, because I know how young that is and how inappropriate and inexcusable it is. And had my mother and parents found out that that had happened, I'm sure there'd be major consequences for the perpetrator.
You talk about that. You talk about an abortion you had when you were with your first, the first love of your life, your first boyfriend, Bruce. You also talk about the two marriages that you have had, one to, you know, the very well-known publicist who worked with you through the crisis, and then, of course, the basketball player, Rick Fox. Now that you've put it out there, how do you feel?
Well, I feel good because it's not a tell-all. It's not a sordid tale to capitalize on any misery. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to write a memoir, you know, back in the day, right on the heels of a scandal, because that's all I would have been able to talk about is the scandal. And, you know, people, it would have validated people's point. Well, you know, winning Miss America and being dethroned is the best thing that ever could have happened to her. No, it's not.
What do you want people to draw from this book that you just co-wrote with your mom? What would you hope they take away from it?
I hope that they see the force of nature that my mom is and that has rubbed off on me. That I was really blessed to have two parents who gave me a foundation. And I was always lucky to have parents that were willing to forgive and accept me for who I was through every catastrophe that happened in my life. They never said, I told you so, or well, you're stupid, what are you doing, you're ruining your life. They said, okay, well, we're here for you. We love you, and we'll get through this together.
Vanessa Williams is a multiple Grammy-nominated and Emmy-nominated actress and singer. The woman who helped her get there is her mother, Helen Williams. Together, they co-wrote You Have No Idea, a memoir about their triumph through life's twists and turns. And Vanessa Williams was kind enough to join us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Vanessa Williams, thank you so much. Congratulations on everything, and happy Mother's Day to you and your mom.
Thank you so much.
Now it's time for the occasional feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we ask some of our guests what they're listening to these days. Today we're going to hear some music that inspires actress and singer Lisa Celeste. She's better known by her stage name, Simone. That's a nod to her late mother, the legendary singer Nina Simone. Simone has appeared on Broadway in the musicals Rent and Aida. We caught up with her last year, and here are some of the songs she listens to when she's not making her own music.
Hi, my name's Simone, and currently I'm listening to Skin by Ephraim Lewis.
Searching for a way out of so much
I love his vocals, his delivery, his background. I love the production. Everything about it is just perfect.
I'm a public face with a private life. You want to get close enough to touch? Weave your lies, cause I can't hide. Never touch my soul.
And then another one of my favorites I just heard the other day is by Willow Smith. I start whipping my head back and forth and dancing all around. I love that song. Another one that I listen to every evening is Singing Bowls by the artist Hans De Beck. Really helps me to come down at the end of the day and just kind of focus my mind on the sounds and the different tones of the bowls so that I can rest peacefully.
That was singer and actress Simone telling us what's playing in her ear. To hear our previous conversation with her, please go to our website. Go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bridget Armstrong, Freddie Boswell, Bridget DeShagas, Sanaj Meshkinpour, Amitha Parasher, Amy Ta, and Kenya Young. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar. Our directors are Arjun Hutchins and Emily Oxenschlager. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tevold. He had a hand this week from Sean Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.